time to get started. Just a reminder that we do have an exam this week, and I just want to let you know I'm actually moving this week, so it may be that if you email me over the weekend, I may not have internet, which means my answer it might have to be on the phone, which means it could be cryptic, so don't expect me to write out a solution to some problem for you in email. That won't happen. However, we'll see. Maybe I get my internet set up. But it's a bit of a distraction from that. So I apologize if I'm a little slow responding to emails this week, not on the weekend. I am scheduling a Q&A session on Monday. So the spirit of that is, I don't really think of that as so much of a pedagogical event as a time for me to try to answer any last minute questions that you have. So I won't be trying to pull answers out of you, but rather if you ask a question, I'll just try to lay out the answer as best I can. And pretty much anything is game. I mean, obviously I won't tell you exactly what's on the test, but I will try to answer whatever you ask. And if you were to ask something that is specifically on the exam, I'm not going to avoid it. I'll just answer what you ask. So that's the spirit of it. So if you have last-minute questions, feel free to come to that. Again, I'll apologize that it's just impossible for me to find the time that will work for everybody, but I'll set up a doodle poll, so I'll at least try to find a time that works for as many of you as I can get. So, okay, and then once I find the time, I actually have to go through the hassle of getting a room, which sometimes is hard. Sometimes not, so we'll see. Anyway, I'll let you know when that happens. Does anybody have any questions concerning exam mechanics and how it's going to happen? Material coverage, you're good. Okay, send out an email with all that. So. Okay, anything about the exam? All right. So last time, I was looking at a very particular geometry, because it turns out to be quite useful. And it's a geometry that starts out with the building block of an infinite sheet of charge. And we use a Gaussian surface with basically, it could be any shape, but you could have a pipe or a square if you wish, with end caps that are parallel to the plate. And then using Gauss's law, you can show that the electric field is uniform on each side of the plate, pointing away from the plate. The plate has a constant positive sigma. And it has a magnitude of sigma over 2 epsilon naught. So then I use this as a building block and put two of them together in parallel, one with positive sigma and one with negative sigma. And so with the positive sigma in blue here, you have field lines going out. And it seems a little bit bizarre, but this is a uniform field going away from the sheet, and it does not fall off as you get further away from the sheet. It's constant in magnitude. And that will certainly seem unphysical, but then the boundary condition of what we start with is unphysical because we have an infinite sheet of charge. So, at any rate, so we have the uniform electric field going away from this sheet on each side, and then similar, and with this, it's sigma is the same in magnitude, we have a similar field pointing in toward the other sheet. And if you now put them in parallel, put them in geometry where one is parallel to the other, you can see that the field lines cancel here, they cancel here, and they add together here. So you get a uniform field between these sheets of sigma over epsilon naught. Okay, and you'll just find that's a very useful thing. So in particular, this turns out to be a good model for a circuit element we're about to talk about, a capacitor. It also is a nice way of creating an easy to understand confined electric field, which is something that we'll often want to play with a bit. And in fact, that is our model that is sort of a good mental model for the next thing I want to talk about, which is capacitance or a capacitor. So just as an aside, I want to get to the energy density stored in an electric field, and I would like to do that by using the concept of capacitor. Capacitance in and of itself, capacitors are not going to be on your exam. The electric field, energy stored in an electric field is in principle on your exam because it's in chapter whatever, 22 or whichever one it is, the last one here. And you have one or two problems on that. So it's a little bit confused here, but I'm not going to ask you anything about capacitance, but in principle, at the level at which you have problems in a workshop or the problem set that have to do with energy stored in an electric field, in principle, I might ask you something about that, okay? All right, so a good mental model of a capacitor is a parallel plate. In general, of course, in the real world, it's hard to have it carry around infinite sheets of charge, so we usually make it a good bit smaller. But if you think about it, even if I have two small sheets and I put them fairly close to each other, if I'm here in the middle, to a good approximation, it seems infinite. The edges seem infinitely far away. So an infinite sheet model works well for much of this. Clearly, it will not work as you get close to the edge. So the degree to which it doesn't work really will depend on the sort of size of the thing. But for most things that you'll deal with in this class, we will not be worried about those edge effects, but just be aware that they exist. As you'll see in a moment, if you have an actual real element in a circuit that is supposed to do what this capacitor does, which we'll talk about in a second, this probably isn't the geometry you use, actually. They're much better geometries, so we'll talk about that in a second. So this is a good example of a capacitor. What a capacitor does is it basically, just like we've already seen, it effectively packages the electric field or stores it. It also stores charge because, in this case, we've deposited positive charge on one and negative charge on the other. And so it's a nice place to store charge. What we saw last time, I did some hand-waving stuff to sort of make hopefully some sense to you. If I have these two conductors, and they could actually be quite different shapes and different relative locations to each other, if I were to deposit a positive charge on one and a negative charge on the other, such that the total charge is zero, then the potential difference I would have between those conductors you can find here. This V would be the potential difference between the conductors. This would be the amount of charge. And this C, in this case, although it looks like the same C we use for everything else in physics, this one stands for capacitance. And it is a geometric factor that describes the size, relative location, and shapes of these various conductors. What it basically says is, different ways to phrase it, depending on if I put a certain potential difference across two conductors and they're connected where they can draw charge, they will draw an amount of charge that depends on their geometry. Or another way to say it is, if I put a certain amount of charge on these conductors, then there will be a potential difference between them that depends on this quantity, this capacitance. Okay? So I think capacitance is a little bit of a fuzzy thing initially. So, if I were to put something in a circuit, for example, we represent capacitors with these parallel plates. This is known as an EMF, for electromotive force. think of it as a battery, and on the long side it is positive charge, on the other side it's negative charge. So basically an EMF is a general word for something that can take charge and do work to separate it. Okay, so that's what a battery does. A 1.5 volt battery will take some positive charge and put it here, and some negative charge and put it here, such that it would take 1.5 volts, you know, work per unit charge, to go from one pole to the other. So that's what it does. So there are different ways of doing this, but the thing you normally keep in mind is just the battery. And then on the other side, this is a capacitor. Usually you just write a C. The units are in farads. And what will happen is, if I put a bunch of positive charge here, this is a conductor, so that charge flows freely. So that charge will distribute itself on this conductor, and the negative charge similarly. And you basically have the geometry that we just discussed. So that's sort of the mental model that you want to have. So what this says is that for a given voltage that you have across your EMF, because this is a conductor, it takes no work per unit charge to come over here, which means that's the same voltage you have across these two plates, and therefore Q is equal to CV. If you have this C, that tells you how much charge resides on each of those plates, which is actually how you end up using it a lot of the time. Okay? So let's zoom in a bit, and let's suppose that we have our plate looking like this, and another plate that looks like this. And let me draw a Gaussian surface like this. We know the electric field between the plates. And let's say that we have a distance d separating the two plates. The plates have area A, the flux is going to be the electric field if the Gaussian surface basically has this surface of the Gaussian surface basically also has area A. So the integral of E dot dA is just equal to the magnitude of E times A. It's also equal to Q enclosed divided by epsilon naught, and that's going to be equal to sigma times A divided by epsilon naught, because that's the amount of charge you have on that surface of the plate. So we have that E times A is equal to sigma A over epsilon naught, or the magnitude of E is equal to sigma over epsilon naught, which you already know. The voltage, the potential difference across the plates, remember, is the work per unit charge takes to move charge from one plate to the other. Work per unit charge is going to be Q times the electric field going across, but it's work per unit charge, so the Q cancels out. So the work that I do, the work per unit charge that I have to get across the plates, is just equal to the electric field times the distance d. So Q is equal to CV, which means the capacitance is equal to the charge over the voltage. The charge is sigma A. The voltage goes as E times D. And I can substitute in for E. And I get epsilon naught times A over D. So if I take this simple geometry and I basically try to find what the capacitance is in terms of this geometry that we've set up, what you find is that the capacitance of this system depends on the area and the distance between plates and this constant. And this, that's in pure geometry. And this is a very particular example, but use different geometries, you'll get something similar. It might be impossible to calculate, but basically the capacitance only depends on geometry. Okay. Yeah.
So other than the edges, that's the actual shape of the place that matter.
Yeah.
So they have the same.
Yeah. I mean, if you are going to design computer circuits, you are probably going to really have to worry about edge effects because capacitors in the circuit are going to be really small. And so one of the things that we'll find, the other thing, and we'll get there, is real circuits are much more complex than we're sort of starting with right now. In the real world, you will have to worry about edge effects, potentially. In general, for a real capacitor in a macroscopic circuit that you build, they often have basically conducting foil and stuff and some geometry such that the actual size of the conductors near each other is so large compared to the edges, you probably don't need to worry about it in those. But I think as you go to a system like a computer chip circuit where things are very small, my guess is you have to worry about eventually you have to worry about quantum effects, but even prior to that, my guess is you have to worry about edge effects. It's a little more complicated than that in the sense that one of the things that we will find is that if I take charges and I move them, such as charges moving in a wire, they will also create magnetic fields. And those magnetic fields can then affect the movement of charges in other parts of the circuit. And so this is a form of we call that in particular self-inductance. What it means is that parts of the circuit over here can talk to parts of the circuit over here, and it all can sort of get confused. And so this is the reality of what makes it hard to do a lot of circuits and things. So we have to worry about that. And in addition, for small circuits, you have the issue that as you move charges through real materials, they lose some energy that comes out in heat, and so you also have to worry about heat removal and melting the circuit and everything. But for the most part, we will try to stay away from reality insofar as we can in this class, so that we can sort of understand the essence of it, because reality is tough. Okay, so what I'd like to do now is to think about energy involved in capacitors. So you can imagine that we have a circuit with an EMF. And Let's say that we have a switch. So I have a piece of the circuit that can close down onto the rest of the circuit, but it's open right now. And then I have a capacitor, which is initially uncharged. And let's say that sometime later, we close the switch. And when we do that, then you can imagine that charge will begin to flow over to this uncharged capacitor. And at any given moment, so let's choose an arbitrary moment, and at that moment we will have charge flowing to the capacitor, but the capacitor will already have some charge Q prime. Okay? So this is at the first instant Q prime will be zero. But at some time T will have a charge, Q prime, and there will still be charge flowing over to the capacitor. So I want to sort of look at that physical system and see if I can understand. And at any given moment, as the charge flows, the potential difference between the two plates grows. But at any given instant, the relationship between the charge and that potential difference is fixed. Because if I freeze it in time, even if I don't have the full ultimate charge over here, if I have just a Q prime, if I were to take a charge from one plate and move it to the next, there will be a potential difference. That potential difference will depend on the electric field between those plates at that moment, which depends on the sigma that's there, which depends on Q prime. So it doesn't matter what the ultimate Q will be at that moment. You're only dealing with what's currently there. So that means that Q prime is equal to C times V prime. So V prime represents that instantaneous voltage between the two plates at the moment that the plates have Q prime on them. And note that I don't have a prime on the C here. The C represents capacitance, and it only cares about the geometry, and the geometry is not changing. So that constant of proportionality is true throughout, regardless of how much charge you put over there. Okay. So, in order for this dQ to be flowing over here, imagine that I have a Q prime over here, so there's positive charge over here now. That means it takes some work for me to move charge across. Okay? And so the differential work it takes to move a differential dQ is going to depend on, effectively, on what that potential difference is. So the differential work is equal to Q prime over C times dQ prime. So the total work it would take if I start with zero charge on the plate and then keep moving little dQs over until I get a final charge, big Q, on that plate would be summing up over all the little the work that it takes to move all the little differential pieces of charge over. So the total work it takes to charge the plates is equal to the integral of all these little dWs, which if I'm summing over charge would be zero to big final Q, Q prime over C times dQ prime. C is a constant, pulls out. The integral of Q prime, dQ prime, is just Q prime squared over 2. and take it between the limits of big Q and 0. It's just big Q squared. So I get 1 over C times big Q squared over 2. If I rewrite Q, so with these EMFs, sometimes people will just write V. Sometimes they'll put this little E and then give you the value of the potential difference. This device holds a constant potential difference between these two plates. So what that means is it will throw charge over here until the potential difference between these two plates is exactly the same. That make sense? So this C and that C are the same. This big Q is just big C, big V. And so you end up with 1/2 CV squared. I don't know why, but I always find this easy, one of the easy ones to remember, because it's very similar to 1/2 MV squared, and it sort of deals with energy, but they're different things. But nevertheless, that probably says more about my brain than anything else, I suppose. Strangeness. So what this says is that if you have a capacitor in a circuit, then the energy it takes to charge the capacitor is usually actually given a symbol U, and it's equal to 1/2 CV squared. Sometimes that's the convenient term, the convenient way in which you want to use it. Sometimes you want to rewrite things. So if I want to get rid of the V and write that in terms of Q's and C's, then this would be 1/2 Q squared over C. If I want to get rid of the C, this would be 1/2 Q times V. So depending on if you're actually solving a problem and you need to do something with a capacitor like this, sometimes you may be given 2 of these but not the third. So just use whichever form you like. Okay? So this is not just the energy it takes to charge the capacitor. In this limit, in this, we're assuming that to shove the charge through the wires, it takes no extra work. That is, we're assuming it to be friction-free, or what we would call resistance-free. So I'm not losing energy to anything else. So if this is the amount of energy that it takes to charge the capacitor, this is also the energy stored in the capacitor. Okay? How is that energy stored?
In what form?
Got chemical potential energy. I can roll in a waterfall, you've got gravitational potential energy. How's the energy stored here?
Electrostatic potential energy.
Yeah. We can interpret it as energy is actually stored in the electric field. Is a way to think about it. So if we look at it that way, we can ask, for a given electric field, what is the energy density that it carries?
Well,
So remember, what we have is sort of a plus q over here, a minus q over here, and we have no electric field when there's no charge there, and then as we build the charge up, we create this electric field. And that electric field is well understood. So if we want to ask what is the energy density, then we want to take the total energy that is stored and divide it by the total volume. So I'm going to, when we talk about the energy density of the electric field, rather than a big U, U often means energy or potential energy. It's usually written in some sort of weird script. So I'm going to have U sub E, where it's sort of a weird script U. Now, you may not like script U's, but just remember, I could use the same U and all the same C's, and it just gets more and more confusing. So you should be very thankful when people decide to use script rather than regular U's. It's not just me that's deciding this. I mean, in general, the symbols I'm going to use are the standard ones you just find throughout. And sometimes it is beyond me why certain things became the convention. Like, I mean, I find it annoying that we have C representing almost everything in physics. I don't know why. Well, I told you why. It probably does have to do with job security, but... okay, so the energy density is going to be the total energy in the capacitor divided by the volume between the plates. So that's going to be 1/2 times CV squared divided by the distance between the plates times the area of the plates. Remember that the capacitance for parallel plates, we've determined, depends on the geometry, and it's A times epsilon naught divided by D. So if I substitute in for C, the energy density in the electric field is 1/2 times A epsilon naught over D, substituting for C, times V, but V is the electric field times D, and V is squared, so these are both squared. And then, okay, so what I've got is 1/2, that's the 1/2. This is the capacitance here. I've rewritten V, the potential for parallel plates is just the electric field times the distance. So I've rewritten that, so that's electric field squared times V squared. And now I have to divide by D times A. Okay. Now if I didn't drop things, then this just gives me epsilon naught over 2 times the magnitude of the electric field squared. And although we used a very particular geometry to calculate this, but the way that we've set it up, we've asked what is the energy density in this electric field. And it just happens that this geometry is one where we can calculate that. But once you have electric field, you don't actually care where it came from. So this turns out to be a general result for electric fields. Anywhere, anytime, anytime you have it. So this is a general result. And just to sort of come back to something we talked about at the start, I hope by now the electric field is beginning to feel a bit more real to you. Because you're starting to visualize it. Now we've even said I have an electric field that stores energy. So there's some starts to begin to have some reality to it. Just to remind you, remember where it came from. We just pulled it out of thin air in order for perhaps for calculational convenience. And, you know, with that concept, now it begins to take on a life of its own. So now, if you have electric field, you also have energy, and you even have a way of calculating energy in a system. So I may come back to this and calculate the electric. No, let me actually do this for a moment. So you've spent a lot of time calculating electric fields in different ways. If I were to ask you what is the energy stored in the system, you calculate the electric field, and then you can determine its energy because you know its energy density, which means you can integrate. If you know the energy density, you know how the electric field changes in space, you can integrate that electric field density, energy density, over all the space, and you can calculate energy. Okay, so for any given Gaussian surface problem or whatever, if it asks what is the total energy in the system, you can assume that it's all stored in the electric field. If you've calculated the electric field, you should be able to integrate out the electric field, integrate the energy density of the electric field over the volume, and figure out what the total energy is. So you can imagine if we have sort of a spherical system with a couple of spheres that might be conducting or have charge on them, and then we have some rho, which is a function of R here. You can calculate the electric field, you know, using Gaussian surfaces in different places, and then the total energy. It's just the integral over the total volume of this energy stored in the electric field, energy density, dV.
It might be a pain
because you've calculated the electric fields plenty of times. Now imagine integrating this thing where you actually have to square the electric field. So I'm not saying it's always going to be easy, but okay. All right, so I will not ask you anything on the exam about capacitance. I just wanted to use capacitance to sort of extract this energy density in the electric field, and we're going to go on and do more things with capacitance, but in terms of what is relevant for your exam, it's just this, of the stuff that we did today, okay? Because that chapter talks about energy in the electric field. And I actually forget how they do it, but I think they do it without capacitance. I don't remember whether they just ad hoc tell you or not. But for any problem where you have an electric field that you calculate, in principle, you can now integrate this energy density to get the energy stored in that system as well. Can tell you're excited by that. All right, so a little bit more on capacitance. In terms of building real-world circuits, you can generally think of, you might have multiple capacitors in a system. And you can think of any system of capacitors that you have as being made up of parts where capacitors are said to be in series. Or it could be that you have a system where you can think of capacitors that are in parallel. And very often you'll have both. So one of the things that you'll find that is often useful to do is you may have a circuit that has very particular little parts that are in it, have different capacitors. Sometimes it's useful to not think of that as a bunch of little parts, but to pretend that you have a shoebox that you put around all that and you call it a single capacitor. And then ask, if I know what's going on with the parts, what would be the capacitance if I put this in a shoebox and ask what's the capacitance of the whole? So that is a very relevant thing you'll have to deal with a lot. So what we want to do is to look at these different systems and ask, what is the capacitance of a system of capacitors? So first what I'd like to do is to look at this. This would be, we would say that these are in parallel, the capacitors here. So let's start out with a system where we have capacitors in parallel. So I'm going to set up that system. I'm going to say that I put a potential difference across these two conducting wires. And that I have one capacitor here, another capacitor here, all the way up to the nth capacitor. And they are all in this geometry, this parallel geometry. You with me? All right, so if you think about it, this is a conductor, which means all of this wire across each capacitor is at the same potential. And over here, then you have the same potential. So there's a potential difference that is clearly the same across each of these individual capacitors. So that means I have a relationship that governs this first capacitor, which is that the charge on that first capacitor is equal to the capacitance of that first capacitor times that potential difference. The charge across capacitor 2 is equal to C2 times that potential difference, and the charge across the nth capacitor is equal to C(n) times that potential difference. So the total charge that is spread across this side and that side, the total Q, is going to be equal to Q1 plus Q2 plus all the way up to Q(n). Q1 is equal to C1 times V. Q total I can think of as the capacitance of this entire bunch times that potential difference. So the potential difference now is the same everywhere. And so I get that the capacitance of the total is equal to C1 plus C2 on up to Cn. just the arithmetic sum of the capacitors that you have in parallel. Okay, any questions on that? This would be for capacitors in parallel. You'll have to use it a lot, so I'm circling that with red. Okay, so let's look at the other way of doing this. Let's suppose that we have again, a potential difference V between two conductors. And now we set it up so that we have C1 here, C2 here, and Cn here. And this time they're in series, because if you were a charge, in a sense, you'd have to go through each of them if you could. And now what I'd like to consider is, suppose I were to draw a shoebox around this and ask, what is the C total here? If you want to think about it, if I have a positive charge and I try moving it through the system, then I have to do a certain amount of work to get across that gap, which is equal to the voltage across that gap. Then I have to do the same here, and the same here, and the same here. So the total amount of work it takes to go from this wire to that wire per unit charge is this big V. But the way this is set up, that big V is made up of the little voltages across each of these different capacitors. Okay. So we say that we have a voltage drop across each of these capacitors. Another thing that's helpful is to consider what happens with the total charge. If I think of this as a single capacitor and I put it across a potential difference, it sucks up a certain amount of charge, which is the total charge on that capacitor. Physically, what's happening is these conductors, this conducting piece right here in the middle between C1 and C2, that conducting piece, it's not connected to any of the other wire. So physically what's happening is I put a charge here on this plate and it will induce, remember it'll have an electric field, so it pulls free charge up here, and so I get a negative charge there of the same magnitude. Because that's induced, that's left a positive charge here of the same magnitude, which leaves a negative charge here of the same magnitude on all the way down until I get like the negative charge total on the bottom plate. Okay? So when you have these things in parallel, it may seem sort of odd, but you have the same total charge across each of the plates. Okay?
Is
So that's the relationship of Q total and T total. The total potential that you have is going to be equal to the potential difference across 1 plus the potential difference across 2 plus the potential difference across the nth. I can rewrite this as Q total over C total. The potential difference across 1 is equal to the charge across 1, which is Q total, divided by C1 plus Q total divided by C2 divided by C to N. So the Q totals all cancel, and I end up with 1 over C total is equal to the sum of 1 over C sub I. And you use this relationship for capacitors in series.
So what it tells you is that if I have some I capacitors in series, 1 over that total capacitance is the sum of 1 over the individual capacitances. Okay? Again, it's just the formula that we use a lot. So it turns out that any given circuit of an arbitrary geometry generally will break down into parts where capacitors are in parallel and parts where they're in series. And so you sometimes have to sort of piecemeal work your way through the circuit to figure out what's going on with the various capacitors and where the charge resides, and eventually we'll find how the current flows. So any questions on this? Okay, so I'm going to leave that there and not do examples for the moment. We'll see how this is used before long. So for right now, it's just very theoretical. These are the formulas that are useful, and this is how you think through the way of getting them. So far, everything that we've talked about, you can think of as electric fields being in a vacuum, short of the materials, the conductors or the non-conductors that we put there. And when we put the non-conductors there, we basically make the assumption that all they do is allow a matrix where you're putting charge, but we don't really talk about it any more than that. Okay. So now, having told you that for the most part we're going to ignore the real world, I'm now going to start talking a bit more about real-world effects, because we can't really ignore it.
So what we want to do is to talk about the electric field in materials. So we've talked a lot about conductors, and a conductor is just a material where the charge flows freely. In the real world, it doesn't really quite flow freely, and you do have to worry about energy loss sometimes, because if you want to think microscopically, you can think of particles moving through a matrix, and sometimes they hit nuclei and everything. So you lose a little kinetic energy. It tends to take the form of heat. So if you were to take a wire and heat it up a lot, or put a lot of current through it, which is moving charges, it'll actually just get very, very hot. So there are materials where this doesn't happen, but they're very special materials called superconductors that we're not going to really talk much about, although one of you may decide to do that for on your projects at the end of the term, which I'll get back to you on shortly. I wanted to sort of let us get through exam one first. But we primarily think of the world broken up in conductors, think metal, where the charge flows freely, and non-conductors.
Okay.
clearly, that's too simple.
If you start talking about a world in which there are conductors and non-conductors, then you understand what you're talking about. So we don't want to do that. All right? What we want to do is talk about a world in which you have conductors and dielectrics. Okay? That way nobody has any idea what you're talking about. So, for whatever reason, when we talk about non-conducting materials, we talk about it being a dielectric.
If a problem is written and it says a dielectric material, blah, 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 that is not a conductor. So do not assume it's a conductor. Assume it is a non-conductor. And then it will tell you about whatever the characteristics are of that material. All right. So if you've had any chemistry at all, you almost certainly have heard about polar and nonpolar materials. Okay, so a polar material is one where
whatever it is that makes it up, it has a natural separation of positive and negative charge that's just built into the system. So you can think of it as a little dumbbell. It's made up of little dumbbells with a positive charge on one side and a negative charge on the other.
In reality, how big that charge separation is, how big the charges are, and how much they're separated depends very much on the material itself. So, in a very important example that you run into in chemistry a lot is water, which is made up of an oxygen molecule which tends to have more negative charge around it. In fact, an excess of 2 electrons worth of charge. And there's a very particular sort of triangular geometry for water. And you have the hydrogens over here, which sort of have a positive charge.
But it is inherent, it's an inherent dipole.
You can also have materials where you have a symmetry such that there is no inherent dipole at all to begin with. So the classic chemistry example of that is carbon tetrachloride. So each chlorine has sort of a negative charge. The carbon has a +4. And then this is sort of hard to draw. Can imagine having the bond go coming out here to this chlorine and then going in to that chlorine. So what I'm trying to draw there is what would be known as a tetrahedral geometry. So I have 2 chlorines like that and 2 like that, basically all spread out evenly. And so because of the symmetry, even though each chlorine is holding a little bit more of the electron charge and the carbon has a bit more of the positive charge, it's all very symmetric. So there is no net separation of charge. So that would be a classic example. Now these are really very different substances. I don't know to what extent you've ever... Sometimes some substances will dissolve very easily in water, but not
in something else, right? Or, you know, sometimes oil floats on water, for example. But it doesn't dissolve in water very well. Generally speaking, polar materials will tend to be soluble in polar solvents and the other way around. So if you're doing chemistry, this is everything. Whether something is polar or not determines a lot about its macroscopic chemical characteristics in terms of miscibility with other substances and reactive nature. But we're not going to worry too much about the details, but I just want to sort of paint the picture. So this is very true in reality. Real materials will have these two basic characteristics. And the way to think about it is, in the physics world, is if you have a material that's made up of little dipoles, then you can just think of it being made of little dipoles. All with these little random orientations. Okay, so if I have no electric field, they're all randomly oriented. But now, if I take this very same material and I put an electric field across that material, then each of these little dipoles, if you imagine this is a positive charge and this is a negative charge and these are sort of hooked together in a little dumbbell, if I have an electric field that way, this positive charge is going to want to go that way and the negative charge is going to go that way. So there'll be a torque on this dipole. There'll be torque as an angular force trying to rotate it in the orientation of the field. Depending on the material, that may be easy to do or hard to do. So for some materials, these charges may move fairly freely, and others less so. So what will happen is that you will start to get these dipoles will approximately align with the field. If they're real materials, then you may have vibration going on, you may have kinetic motion, if it's a gas, if these things moving around. So you have a lot of things that may be knocking them out of alignment. In addition, they could be held in some sort of crystalline lattice sort of thing so that it's actually hard for them to deform and rotate the field. So when I say approximately lines the field, it is a material dependent thing, the degree to which these little dipoles can align with the field. For the nonpolar substance, you imagine that you have some charge and maybe some other charge sort of spread around in some symmetric way. And now if I take this stuff and I put an electric field on it, then what can happen is that you can tend to get an asymmetry in the charge distribution a little bit. The fact that you have it in an electric field will begin to force this fully symmetric system to turn into something that's slightly asymmetric and will actually give you a dipole. And it will align with the field. But this separation will necessarily align with the field. And you can imagine if I did this really in an extreme way, right? absolutely massive field, I just rip it apart. All right, so that's the extreme case. But if I don't have that much, basically it still is the stuff that it was, but it now will have a little dipole induced. So you can, the E can induce a dipole. And the material elements or the molecules. Okay? So if you just stop and think about it for a moment, in both instances, it's not crazy to think the degree to which these dipoles align will depend on the strength of the field. If I have a really strong field here, then clearly it's going to fight these other processes more. It'll be a bigger torque, and I will align more and more of these things with the field. Here, the bigger the field is, the more this separation is going to be. So in both cases, it's not crazy to make an assumption about how the separation goes. It's proportional to the strength of the electric field. If you have that, then what you have is something that's known as a linear dielectric. So what it's telling you is that if I have no electric field, either the dipoles are completely randomly oriented or there are no dipoles at all, and I have no net electric field inside this material. There's no funky alignment. If I have an electric field, then as the electric field strength grows, I will either align more the natural dipoles or I'll begin to form natural dipoles in the material, and I will get this growing alignment of dipoles within the material itself. We'll talk about what that effect does in just a minute. Okay? And in many materials, and it makes some sense to think that the degree of all that alignment is going to be linearly proportional to the strength of the electric field. It doesn't have to be that way. This is the assumption that you will use throughout your undergraduate career. If you decide to go to graduate school, well, I don't know, if you're in engineering, you might have to deal with the real world. When you go to graduate school, you find that the world is dramatically more complex than this, and the mathematics becomes dramatically more complex than this. Physically, and in your intuition, this is fine. This works well, and it actually does model a lot of materials, so it works pretty well. But in the real world, you could have, for example, a crystal where the structure of the crystal constrains the movement of the charges such that you induce a dipole, but it will be induced in some weird direction, which means the mathematics isn't so simple as sort of inducing the dipole along the field. You now have to have some strange mapping between the direction of the field and the orientation of this crystal, which means the mathematics you use is no longer going to be sort of vector mathematics. You have to go to much more complex things, which are called tensors, and it becomes awful. It makes your first year in graduate school highly painful. But lots of things are sort of that is one of the biggest changes, say, from undergraduate physics to graduate physics, is when you make the jump from things that are linear and you can sort of intuitively into things that can go three-dimensional distortion. So the same sort of thing might happen with materials as you you can have materials that if you stretch them, they might break. They might linearly stretch, and then at a certain point they'll break, and you can think of that as some linear thing. But you can imagine having materials where as you start to stretch them and everything, how they break depends on the actual directions in which you're stretching. So it's just much, much more complex. So if you do engineering, you'll almost certainly, you may have to make that jump much earlier because real materials have. At any rate, let us think for a moment about why I'm talking about these stupid dipoles. Imagine that I have a couple of plates where I've separated charge. So what that means is if I just have those plates in this world, then I know that with these parallel plates, I have an electric field. Actually, let me use... I have an electric field that's well understood in that region of space. Okay? Now, imagine that I put inside this region a material. And that material is made up of a linear dielectric. So within that material, you can imagine, let's take just a tube of that material. So we're going to sort of look at this tube. If I put an electric field there and I have dipoles in there, it's going to pull some negative charges over here and some positive charges like that. So if you stop and think about it, what you've ended up doing is on the edges of this material, you've sort of created some positive charges over here and some negative charges over here. In other words, this material, if it were a conductor, what would happen? I would pull a lot of positive charge to the one side, a lot of negative charge to the other side, to the point where I have an electric field at zero in the middle. Now with a dielectric, I'm pulling a little bit of the charge, which is the product of the alignment of these dipoles. So you can think of it as sort of partial inducement of charge to cancel out the field, but it can't do it completely because the charge really can't move. I'm just aligning these dipoles. So what will happen with this induced charge is it will give me a small electric field going the other way. The size of this induced field will depend on my ability to align these dipoles. And that will depend on the material. Okay? But I get partial cancellation. So in the end, this field out here, I will call an external electric field. And then the field that I end up with in here is basically going to be the net field inside is going to be the electric field external plus the induced electric field, which is going in the opposite direction. So what will end up is I will have an electric field inside the material that is reduced relative to this external electric field. Okay? And the level of that reduction is going to depend on the material, and it's going to be linear in the electric field because the degree to which I can align things depends on that. Okay? I hear the hordes at the door, so we're out of time. Any questions? All right, see you Thursday.
So the idea is that the finish line and the tip is also 17 centimeters apart. With
Do you remember that?
So there's a trick that I'm going to talk about.
Yeah, I know there's a
super
but why there's actually nothing in the
Well,
so it's just because it's not a very symmetric.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you have to be careful because you can't. Gauss's law calculates the electron spin. You use the superposition for it, superimpose two symmetrics.
So if there's a cavity which is just in the center of the sphere, that is inside that cavity, the electron field is just in the center of the sphere.
Yeah, it's a spherical problem.
Outside my office door.
Okay.
It's all stacked there.